From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his long lifetime, Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman has gone from marginal free market rebel to perhaps the most central, influential economist of the last half century, and maybe more. Tonight on Point, a conversation with Milton Friedman on his half-won battle for free market dominance and the way ahead for the U.S. economy. Milton Friedman is the uber champion of free markets, of getting government out of the way. His teachings have reached far beyond the borders of the United States into countries as different as Chile and China. At age 92, he remains a true radical. Already in the 1950s, he advocated a flat tax and school vouchers. Today, Milton Friedman says that free market thinking under President Bush is still winning what he calls the war of ideas. Now, this free market radical is impatient to see those ideas put more fully, more radically into practice. Tonight, we'll talk with Milton Friedman on free markets and his half-won battle for the U.S. economy. What do you think? Are you rooting for total victory for the free marketeers or for reassessment of the free market juggernaut? In the 25 years since Ronald Reagan brought Milton Friedman's free market resurgence into the White House, what have we learned? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Milton Friedman, winner of the 1976 Nobel Prize in Economics. He's been an economic advisor to Barry Goldwater and Republican president since Richard Nixon. At 92, he was recently named to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's Council on Economic Advisors, of economic advisors, I should say. He's currently a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution. His many books include Capitalism and Freedom and Free to Choose. Good evening and welcome, Milton Friedman.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks very much for joining us tonight. So you're writing very recently that the battle is half won. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that in the period from the end of World War II to 1980, early 80s, government spending rose much more rapidly than government income, and the fraction of the national's income spent by government more than doubled. The welfare state was growing. It was getting larger. Government was getting more intrusive, more concerned with the details of business and people. Then in 1980, when Reagan came along, he stopped that. He didn't make the government any smaller, but he kept it from growing larger. If you look at the fraction of national income spent by government, especially if you look at it outside of defense, which is a special issue, non-defense spending has stayed at almost the same percentage of national income from 1980 to now. So we've stopped the growth of the welfare state, but we haven't gotten rid of it. We haven't reduced it. We haven't eliminated those intrusive programs of the government that limit our freedom.
So you're saying that since Ronald Reagan, the brakes have been put on the growth in government spending at around non-defense spending at around 30% of national income, and that up from, around 10% in 1950, that you've won the battle of ideas, but that you haven't turned around those numbers, and that's the other half, the second half of the battle you'd like to win.
That's right. I'd like to see that 30% go down to about 10 to 12 to 15%.
Which would mean taking government spending back down to immediate post-war levels or levels around 1950. What would that mean to Americans, Milton Friedman, if your dream was realized, if your battle was won?
But look more broadly historically. Before World War II, except for the periods of war, like Civil War and the First World War, government spending never exceeded more than about 10 or 12% of national income. And those were the years of the great growth of the United States. The period in which we became a major economic entity. So it's not. I'm not talking about doing something that is unprecedented. The same thing goes for other countries. In Great Britain, during the period of Britain's great growth and importance, at the time of Queen Victoria's Jubilee, at the end of the 19th century, government spending was 10% of national income. So that's not an unrealistic possibility.
But when you talk about that happening, you talk about getting rid of a lot of programs Americans have become very familiar with, not to say dependent on, Medicare, Medicaid,
That's
Head Start,
right.
Job Corps, even OSHA, you know, Occupational Safety and Hazard. These have come to seem like elemental parts of American society, things that people can count on. To get down to that government spending at, let's say, 10% of the national income, how would American society change, Milton Friedman?
You would have much more individuality, much more individualism, much more free enterprise, and government and people would be, the economy would be much more productive. You mentioned the medical care system. Look how inefficient the medical care system is now. And the main reason it is because government plays such a key role in it through Medicare, Medicaid, through the special tax provisions for employer-provided medical care. And you have an enormous growth of bureaucracy. The medical science has improved greatly over time, but medical performance has not improved as much as medical science because it's been so inefficiently administered.
But does going to your free market dream, if you could win the second half of the battle, does it mean going back to a kind of charnel house, Victorian poorhouse culture where, you know, if you take away the federal government's oversight of occupational workplace safety, does that mean more fingers and limbs chopped off? If you take away Medicare, Medicaid, does it mean people laying in the streets for want of medical care?
You are assuming what I think you would have difficulty in demonstrating, that the government programs work. They don't. On the contrary, before government got involved in those things, you already had major improvements in health in the workplace. And that would be because competition of employers for employees induced them to improve the conditions of employment. Any set of employers who let people's hands be chopped off regularly would not get many employees. They would find a hard time getting workers to work for them. The market works very effectively and enables people to achieve their true objectives.
Milton Friedman, when you began writing along these lines, you were a child of the Depression, but you, unlike many who grew up during that period, you turned more radically toward free markets and not toward the social welfare model. When you began, those ideas were very, very much out of fashion. They've become dominant through the Republican Party's ascendancy in the United States. So in many ways, half your battle has been won. Have you been surprised in any dimensions by how it's turned out? Have you been, I don't know, have there been upside surprises or have there been disappointments in what you expected when this embrace came?
Have I been surprised by the success or by the failure?
Well, I guess in both directions, upside or downside surprises.
I should emphasize, I don't want to take responsibility for this change in attitudes or ideas. Facts are more important. The reason people changed their views was largely because they discovered that bigger government wasn't always better. They started to find that they had problems with the IRS. They started to find that they had problems with dealing with the justice system. And more recently, the major thing that has sealed the change in ideas was the collapse of the Soviet Union. The fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union clearly had a great deal to do with the basic change in ideological views.
So there's a kind of demonstration, and it was a large one, and those systems have receded dramatically. But I guess the same question remains. Lots of Americans have felt the impact, not as much as you'd like to see, but in a significant degree of the rise of the ideas that you've championed. And I just wonder if you've seen areas in which those did not turn out as well as you hoped, areas in which they've turned out better than you hoped.
Well, I find it hard to think of anywhere it didn't turn out well. It may not have turned out as well as I hoped. But if you think of cases like the deregulation of airlines or the elimination of the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission, those were very successful. The improvement in travel fares are, the cost of traveling by air has come down sharply since deregulation. And I think that's been true wherever you've deregulated. It's very hard for me to come up with any examples of real failure in that sense.
Of course, if you were an American traveler over the holidays when U.S. Airways, which of course is in bankruptcy, operating in bankruptcy, had mountains of luggage piled up and you didn't get your luggage for several days, it might not look like such a great deal.
No, I would not like it at all. But if you were back 20 years, there would have been a third of the, maybe a third or a quarter of the number of people traveling by air. They couldn't afford it. The prices would have been so high. So you can't, there's no such thing as a perfect storm or a perfect success. You do have good things and bad things. And one thing that has happened is that airlines used to be wonderful for wealthy people, but were lousy for low-income people. And now the wealthy people have suffered from that. In general, the interesting thing about this is that most new developments start out by being luxuries for the wealthy and end up being necessities for the poor. Television, the Internet, all are characterized that way. And in an open and free market society, you would have much more experimentation, and progress would be strong. One of the areas in our country which government plays does very badly is in education. And in a free market society, you'd have a much better educational system today. You would not have masses of low-income people who can't read or write or do arithmetic.
You're saying if the country was not so dependent on public schools?
On government schools. They're not public. They're government.
What's the difference?
The difference? Well, now tell me, is the Catholic Church a public institution? Is it a public church? But it's not a government church. So public has a broader meaning than government. But here we are. It's absolutely disgraceful that we today, the literacy level, the level of literacy of the American people is lower than it was 150 years ago. That's the trouble is that, as you say, people get used to things. They don't really recognize what's going on. They don't realize that there is such a situation and that there is an alternative.
Do you think that Americans, after half a century or more of the New Deal and the kind of government support systems that have been in place since the 50s and 60s and 70s, do they still have the character to embrace a Milton Friedman-style free market universe, world?
Well, they sure do. Look at what happened during the Internet period. During the 1990s, and look at what's happening now in various areas. If you leave people alone, they'll do pretty well by themselves. They don't need to have somebody in Washington telling them what's right or what's wrong.
You say that, and yet, as you point out yourself, Milton Friedman, the government spending has not gone down. It's held steady, but it hasn't gone down as a portion of the nation's income. Isn't that a kind of indicator that Americans are reaching out for those things that government's providing?
Well, of course, everybody wants to get the key thing about people is that they want to live at somebody else's expense. And a government is a system, a welfare state is a system where everybody can live at everybody else's expense. So the truth of the matter is that a really free society is a rare event, and it's a miracle when it does happen.
But it happens with free markets. Milton Friedman, please stand by. There's much more we want to hear. We're so glad to have you with us tonight. We're talking with Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman on his free market revolution and where it stands today. You can join the conversation. Milton Friedman says the battle against government and taxes is half won. Are you rooting for total victory for the free market or for reassessment? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman, the great godfather of free market economic philosophy, on the free market revolution, where it stands today. He says the battle is half won, and he'd like to see it go the rest of the way. Don't call me a conservative, says Milton Friedman. Call me a radical, and he means it. And he's swung a lot of influence in the last half century and more. You can join the conversation tonight, what do you think, with 25 years now since Ronald Reagan brought free market ideology back into the White House. What have we learned? What do markets do well, and what do they do poorly? And can you picture Milton Friedman's ideal world without OSHA, without Medicare, with radically less government? Are we headed there? Is it where you want to go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
How are you doing, Tom?
Good, thanks.
Professor Friedman, it's an honor. Tom's questions that he just asked really raised the issue that I want to raise, which is really what governments do well, what economies do well, what markets do well, and what they do badly. You said you can't think of a failure of free market reforms. Let me give you an example that really raises the question. One of the free market reforms was bringing in outsourcing the people who checked baggage and checked security at airports.
Mm-hmm.
And they quickly went, as the market drove them, to the bottom of the heap. They went after the cheapest staff that they could get. And if we rely on the market to do that, we're going to have the poorest trained, poorest educated people checking baggages. That is a government function.
So not at all. First place, who relied on outsourcing?
The
government itself has been relying on outsourcing.
That's right. And
ask a different question for a moment. Who has the greatest interest in seeing that the baggage doesn't go astray?
Well, one would think it would be the airlines, but
exactly.
It was the airlines who hired the companies that were doing the checking.
Milton Friedman, as I recall, the airlines relentlessly pushed to bring down the wages they were paying to minimum wage, and you saw what we got.
If I may?
Yes.
Because I think this is a more general question than just the airlines.
Yeah.
And Dr. Friedman, people take your wisdom about economics, and that's, I take your wisdom about economics quite a bit, but economics isn't the world, and how do you take...
Economics is certainly not the world, and one point I would like to emphasize in terms of the way Tom has been putting this issue is that if you have a 100% free market system, that does not mean that you don't have a government. There are certain basic functions that government does perform and has to perform. You need the government to defend... First of all, the inescapable function is defense. The second function is providing a system of laws and a means of adjudicating disputes among people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to your case of the airlines, the incentive to improve the quality of the baggage handling is much greater for the airline companies than it is for the government. Now, the government isn't doing a particularly good job. Obviously, if you look at what happened over this holiday with baggage, you can't say that the government screening is ideal.
David, I know you're pushing to a larger point here, and there's more we could say about airline security, but are there other examples you would raise where you have a question around the free market impact?
Well, the most obvious one is in environment, where the real question is clearly Professor Friedman recognizes that there is a role for government, but when you're citing the 10% of GDP,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about a time when the role for government was much smaller. There was no need for environmental protection back, or at least we didn't recognize it back in the 19th century.
And the rivers burned in Gary, Indiana.
That's right. So
how do you
advise people who are following your approach, what is an appropriate governmental function? When do the externalities really outweigh the market?
I don't believe you can give a simple, hard, fast rule. I think you do have to look at each case separately and see what the pluses are and what the minuses are. But so far as pollution, the environment is concerned. It's not an accident that the countries that have been most, whose environment was most endangered, were the totalitarian countries. It was Russia. It was China. Those were the places where you had environmental damage to the maximum. The free market countries have done a better job of environment, not through government necessarily, but through private activity.
What would you say then, Milton Friedman, today about the United States and Europe? Europe's, of course, still much more government-oriented, and they seem to be taking greater steps toward environmental protection than the United States right now. So how does that factor into the formula?
Well, you need to look at we don't have any very good evidence on that, I'm afraid.
Well, we know that Europe has more strict regulation of the environment.
Oh,
You're saying that's right,
but we don't know that the environment is any better. You know, Europe had more, until just the last few years, they had much more strict regulation of airlines, and they had much poorer airline service. Now, in the last few years, they have been starting to deregulate the airlines, and you have a host of new small airlines coming into existence. So the problem is, it's so easy to be taken in by the name.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the 100 years ago. We weren't as wealthy then as we are now. We couldn't afford then to spend the money on the environment that you can afford to do now. And how did that wealth come about? The wealth came about through the operation of the free market, through the operation of the capitalist system.
Let me ask you, I mean, people struggle with this. Everyone, I think, recognizes the incentives that system brings to bear and the tremendous fruit that can come from that. At the same time, people have learned through hard and often bitter experience what rapacious dynamics can also come out of the capitalist system. When you ask for the second half of the battle to be won...
Would you give me an example of rapacious dynamics?
Well, I mean, I have relatives who worked in coal mines, and limbs were lost. You know, the robber barons built mansions, and others, you know, barely made a living. It didn't look too good. I mean, it's not hard to see even today. You can look
at. And you think that government coal mines would not have had limbs come off?
I think that I don't know the absolute answer, but I'm tempted to be glad that OSHA is on the scene, looking out for. You know, occupational safety in coal mine tunnels.
Well, look at those cases, those countries. Russia had, the Soviet Union had government-owned coal mines, and they had a very high rate of limbs coming off.
Okay, fair enough. And still, you must frequently, with your self-described radical position on this, you must feel the caution, even the fear that people express in response to your vision, that they felt the sting of the downside of this. Not everybody, but many people over time.
No, there's no doubt that there's an enormous... What you're speaking of is really the tyranny of the status quo. And taking the intention for the deed. The OSHA has a marvelous mission, a marvelous extension. But when people look at how well it's affected, I don't believe they give it very high marks.
For workplace safety?
Yes, we were quite safe now. We were quite safe 50 years ago. We were quite safe 100 years ago.
See, let the market do it.
And you didn't, as I say... You didn't have the... Consider how do people feel about medical care now?
Well, they feel pretty conflicted. They feel like they're overpaying and they're uncertain what they're going to get in return.
Right, and they believe that there's too much bureaucracy.
But
they believe that they're no longer in a position where a patient and a doctor make a deal one with the other.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a third party somewhere else who's telling the doctor what to do, essentially. And that is all entirely, as I believe, a function of excessive government intervention.
What do you think about the stories of corporate corruption that came out of the boom 90s, about Enron and all the rest? How does that factor into your view?
I think that people in any community, in any society, there will always be some people who will be corrupt. Let me ask you, how did the world find out about Enron?
Well, their deal started to unfold after the California energy crisis.
No, but anyway, but tell me, was it the government that discovered that Enron was corrupt?
No.
It was a market.
Yes.
It was a collapse of the price and the stock price. The market doesn't like corruption. The market likes a situation in which people can be trusted, and it therefore punishes corruption very, very heavily.
But that collapse of Enron meant a terrible blow for the retirement of thousands of Enron employees and major losses for others. Are you saying that in order to have the full benefits of capitalism, we just have to get used to a kind of very cruel moments, that there's no mediating
those?
No, I
think something different, that there is no system that you can imagine, no magic system which will avoid having bad things as well as good things. There's no perfect world. And I'm saying that that government is not effective in uncovering and eliminating things like Enron. It's not nearly as effective as a private market is. But that's not to say that everything's going to be ideal. Utopia is not for the not for the real world.
Milton Friedman, a lot of people want to join us. I want to continue bringing them in. David, thanks for your call from Cambridge. Michael is calling from New York City. Hello, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Friedman. You stated that during the pre-war period, low levels of government spending led to America becoming a great economic entity. During that period, though, there wasn't a purely free market. I mean, there was a lot of rent-seeking behavior. There were a lot of negative externalities. There was a lot of exploitation of immigrants and others who had a lack of information or who were otherwise disadvantaged with regard to the market. There was slavery. There was practically forced labor of colonialism and quasi-colonialism. Should we just ignore this history? I mean, would you really, honestly, Dr. Friedman, would you really like to live in a society based on the principle of survival of the fittest? And would you want to live in such a society if, instead of being born with a great economic mind, as you have been, if you had been born as, say, an African-American woman with little educational prospects, in a situation where the invisible hand of the free market was pushing you away from education into a job with no benefits.
Michael, we've got it. Stick with us. Milton Friedman, you want to pick up that line of attack?
Well, I think you do live in a world with the survival of the fittest. Politics, the government, is also a world of the survival of the fittest. The question is whether survival of the fittest in an environment of a free market produces better or worse results than survival of the fittest in a politically controlled world. That's the real issue.
But what about Michael's questions to you about the luck of where you're born? If you were black and a woman or an immigrant without advantage of education pick your year, 1860 or 1890?
Yes. And what would have been better? For her to have been born in the United States in 1880 or 90? Or to have been born in Africa somewhere?
Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on her circumstances either way.
Well, but you have to take the averages. Those of us who were born in the right place are very lucky. I am lucky, you are lucky, if we were born here in the United States. A black woman in 1880, would have had a better chance of a better life if she was born in the United States and almost anywhere else in the world.
Michael, are you satisfied with that?
Well, no, but I don't think I'll get much further with it.
Well, we appreciate your call, Michael. Thanks very much for calling in. Scott's calling from Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you much. Dr. Friedman, you said you're a radical. I'm also a radical, and I would say that I'm a radical moderate. And by that, I mean I'm looking for balance, not false dichotomies that you seem to create. Specifically, I'd like to reference health care.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a physician.
Yes,
and
good.
You've reflected some simply wrong facts during the course of this discussion this evening. You mentioned that these third parties who are intervening, you mentioned at one point that they were government regulations. In fact, as a physician, the most obtrusive third-party regulations with which we deal are from the private sector. They're from private insurance companies, not from the government, which is much more standardized. I would also point out that in the United States, we pay $2 compared to $1 that every other Western industrialized nation spends for even less health care than on average they receive in those other Western industrialized nations, as measured by WHO, World Health Organization parameters. The bottom line in my mind is that we need balance, not one extreme or the other. You need balance between the private and the public sector. You need the tension that I think you fundamentally believe in, the tension of the marketplace. The reality is that the government is part of that marketplace.
Scott, we're coming up to a break. I want to get Milton Friedman's reply. Stick with us. Milton Friedman, Scott's a physician. He feels more interference from his private sector insurance company overseers than from the government.
First of all, I agree with him on the idea of balance. Of course, you want government to do its things and the private world to do its things. The question is, are we in balance now, or are we out of balance? And my argument is that we're out of balance, that we've given too much control and too much power to the government and too little to the private market. Now, if we come to the insurance companies, I'd like to add a few things to what he said. Why is it in the United States that if I live in California, I cannot buy insurance from a company that's in Connecticut? There's no nationwide competition in insurance. That's because of government rules and regulations that are each state has imposed on the insurance industry. It specifies what the insurance contract has to be like. In many cases, so that the much of what he regards as intrusion from the private economy is really the indirect effect of government controls on the private economy, and would not exist in the same way, if at all, in a world in which there was more freedom of contract.
Scott, we've just got a few seconds here before the break. How about it? Pure freedom, would it be better?
It depends on what we mean by freedom. It seems to me that people are free to choose a government. And, in fact, I think Dr. Friedman embraces that idea. So I think it's, frankly, a canard to suggest that freedom is necessarily less government. I submit that balance is the name of the game.
We've got it. The radical moderation voice from Traverse City, Michigan. Scott, thanks for calling in. Milton Friedman, please stand by. We're talking with Milton Friedman tonight about his half-finished free market revolution. You can join us. Has the resurgence of free market thinking saved the United States or undercut its future? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman. For many decades now, Dr. Friedman, 92 years old, has been a powerful advocate of free markets and saying that's where the future lies. He advised Barry Goldwater in that direction and Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. He wrote speeches for Gerald Ford. His influence is enormous and still very much at work today. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Has the resurgence of free market thinking saved the country, pushed it in the right direction, or is it undercutting its future? How do you see it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Milton Friedman, you've been an economist and you've done fundamental work. You've also been very much engaged in the world of White Houses and presidencies. How do you judge the George W. Bush White House on its first term in terms of pushing toward this free market ideal that you still yearn for?
Well, the first term has been dominated, by Iraq, which is really not in – it's on a wholly different level and a wholly different issue of foreign relations. Internally, I believe that the tax reductions, the cuts in taxes, were all to the good because it's the only way to keep pressure on government from spending too much is to keep down the amount of income it gets, same as it is with your child. If he's spending too much, you cut his allowance. And the same way, the public at large, I think, agreed with President Bush that it was desirable to cut the allowance of the government.
But the government hasn't stopped spending. You seem to be supporting the star of the beast.
I was going to go on to the second point.
Yes.
On the other hand, the Bush administration has a very poor record on the spending side. Spending continued to increase. But the reductions in taxes will force an end to that. We have a large deficit now. That brings pressure to hold down spending, and the deficit will disappear.
Why and how will the deficit disappear?
By the growth of the best way would be by cutting down government spending. But that's, as I've been saying, is difficult to achieve. And beyond that, it will disappear by the growth of the economy. How did the deficit disappear in the 90s? Government continued to spend, but the economy grew so rapidly that tax revenue increased rapidly, and we ended up with a balanced budget.
You know, deficits went up during the Reagan years, and they have again during the first term of George W. Bush. Are you concerned, Milton Friedman, that that things are in tension here or in conflict? On the one hand, ideas that you've championed about the free market have proven very saleable and popular in many corners, even politically. But in the American democracy, the spending hasn't really been cut back. Maybe it never will be.
The Reagan period has to be looked at more carefully. Spending outside of the defense did go down in the Reagan period. The deficits arose in the Reagan period from two things. The first was that you had a recession, which was the price of ending inflation. When Reagan came in, inflation rates were up in double digits.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the achievements of Reagan was to end the inflation. But there is no way to end an inflation without going through a period of slower growth. It's one of those things where the good things come early and the bad things late.
Right.
And so the Reagan deficits were a result of two things. One, the defense buildup to end the Cold War. And two, the reduction in tax receipts because of the recession.
But when
those two things are over, from then on, the deficits did come down.
I take your closer analysis of it, but I guess my fundamental question remains, is it possible that your vision and political reality are simply in conflict, that the democracy will always reach out for more support and action by the government than your ideology would support, and therefore you're left with a kind of permanent deficit?
I think that, there's nothing wrong in a way. The deficit is not a real economic problem. What's a problem is what government spends. Whether it pays for it by taxes or whether it pays for it by borrowing, it still uses resources which are not available to the public. But you're getting into a complicated economic issue there.
Let's get another call. Steve's calling.
But I want to say...
Yes, please.
I do want to say that, of course, you're right. It is a real question of whether you can hold down government, because everybody also always wants to benefit at somebody else's expense. And there is a great natural tendency for government is to grow. And it takes a real society who has a real honest-to-God belief in the desirability of freedom and the virtues of free markets to keep government from getting too big.
Let's get another call. Steve's calling from Fullerton, California. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hello. Dr. Friedman, I believe that emerging competition from India, China, the EU, and others will eventually force us to privatize our educational system to some degree to produce higher quality graduates. If you could redesign our educational system, what would the rough outline look like, and what role would government from the federal to local level play in it?
Great question, Steve. Thanks very much. Milton Friedman.
In the ideal world, in my ideal world, government would play no role in it. Parents, with one exception, parents would be responsible for schooling their children, for having their children educated. They would pay the cost. Instead of paying it as taxes to government, they would do it directly. Government's role would be limited to providing assistance in the cases where parents could not afford to school their children. There does need to be some way in which children get educated, and so it has to be available to everybody. But so far as possible, I would do it through the market. We now have exactly the opposite situation. The virtue of competition is that the buyer chooses the product. You go to a store and look at a bunch of cameras and choose it. In education, we have the opposite. The schools choose the students. The public school says everybody who lives in this neighborhood has to go to such and such a school. Now, getting away from the ideal toward the practical, the way to get toward that end result, and I believe you are 100% right that we have to do that, the way to get toward that end result is through a voucher system. Instead of the government spending its money on schools, it should provide a voucher to parents and enable parents to choose the school their children go to, whether it's public or private. And in that way, you would have a great flowering of innovation in education. You would have a major improvement in the opportunities available to people. And the ones who would benefit the most from a system like that would be the low income, the people in the slums of New York and Los Angeles, Chicago, and so on.
Milton Friedman, we've just got a minute left here. We had Peter Drucker with us a couple of weeks ago. He said that he foresees a very rough next 20, 30 years for the U.S., with the U.S. economy getting, and overall, the U.S. power getting cut down to just one of half a dozen global powers. What do you see in the decade, two or three ahead of us?
I don't really agree with him on that. I think it would be good if there were more, if countries like China and India develop and become more efficient and effective. I don't see any virtue in a world with one superpower. Competition is good in governments as in other areas.
And what's your sense of where the Milton Friedman view of the world stands? Is it a high watermark now, or do you feel confident that it'll go on?
I don't think it's a high watermark at all. It's very interesting. The places where it's doing best is in the places that formerly were under the dominance under the Soviet Union, like places like Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia. That's where they're cutting government down to the smallest scale, because they've experienced the extreme opposite, and they are changing. Again, where is government receding the most? In China right now. It was not long ago, 20, 30 years ago, government was responsible in China for something like 70 or 80% of the total output of the country.
And now markets roaring. Milton Friedman with that. I'm afraid we're out of time. It's been great talking with you. Thank you very much for your time this evening.
Nice talking to you.
Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman. In a moment, we mark the passing of former Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm. This is On Point. Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman elected to Congress and the first African-American to make a serious run for the presidency, died over the weekend in Florida. She was 80 years old. Chisholm was first elected to the House from Brooklyn in 1968. She went on to serve seven terms. A tireless champion for the rights of women and minorities, she once said, "My greatest political asset, which professional politicians fear, is my mouth," out of which come all kinds of things one shouldn't always discuss for reasons of political expediency. Tonight we bring you an excerpt of the speech in January of 1972 when Shirley Chisholm announced her run for the presidency.
I think that it is very, very important that all of us in this country today regardless of our particular sex, realize that we've got to come together in order to make the Republic work for everyone, regardless of race, creed, or color. St. Paul said a long time ago, "Let the woman learn in silence." Aeschylus, the great Greek philosopher, said, "Woman, it is thy place to keep quiet and stay within doors." And just 100 years ago, Nietzsche, the German philosopher, said, "When a woman is inclined to learning, there is something wrong with her sexual apparatus." Now, of course, all of these pronouncements were made by gentlemen, so we can understand. But I want to say to you very seriously that the time has come in America when we must try to overcome the traditional feelings and attitudes towards the sexes in this country, because these have been prescribed roles for a very long time in our country. And we now know today, very sincerely and forthrightly, that our nation needs the utilization of its best brain power, whether said brain power can be found in men and or women. There is no psychological test as yet that indicates that man has a superior brain to woman or vice versa. The fact of the matter is realistically that the talents that we have are talents that have been given to us, if you will, by God, and that it is our responsibility to utilize these talents for the amelioration of humanity in a creative and constructive manner. And I find in the United States of America, and I've done quite a bit of traveling, that there are so many hang-ups on sex. Sex physically, educationally, psychologically, and emotionally. There is a preoccupation instead of utilizing those energies in terms of seeing what it is that women and men together today in America can do to straighten out our republic, because our republic is in deep trouble.
Former Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm in a speech from January of 1972. Chisholm died Saturday. She was 80 years old. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.